Welcome to Failure. I'm Ryan Kavanaugh. This is the place where, as they say, success has many fathers and failure has none. Well, failure has found a father, and you're here with us. And we're very lucky today to have one of my closest friends, one of the world's great producers, the world's great marketers, the world's great showmen. And he's truly one of the greatest talents I know. He's one of the main visionaries behind American Idol and producer American Idol and the creator of So You Think You Can Dance, Nigel Lithgow. Welcome, Nigel.
Thank you. Thank you. So happy to be on a program called Failure.
I mean, you know, as soon as I thought who could I bring on Failure, I thought Nigel, right?
Right.
Nigel Failing. No, yeah. But as we all know, this show is it's raw. It's meant to show the world the truth of success, which is in success, success doesn't happen without failure. And Nigel is one of the prime examples of one of the most successful people in his industry, if not the most successful, and one of the greatest talents I know, both creatively and business in that field, and has had his ups and downs. And
Prime example of failure.
Yeah, prime example of failure. So I was trying to be nice about it, but I realized in this show we can't be. But you are. And so, Nigel, you know, I think we'll just start. You know, my path, as you know, which is why I'm doing the show, has been, as I always say, it's a ton of failure after failure, and my success are the moments in between learning how not to fail and then back to failing again. And I don't know if you share exactly that, but I know you started in humble beginnings and you had to work really hard to get where you're going and never give up. So can you maybe start and tell us a little bit about just your beginnings? Like, where'd you come from? What were you doing? What was your family like? What made you you?
Well, I come from Liverpool in England. My dad was a dock worker, a longshoreman, I think you call them here, worked really hard. He was a sergeant major during World War II, and they called him a Little Caesar. So I don't know what that actually means, but he sounded pretty tough. But he was a small man. He was about 5'5", very wiry, I remember, very leathery skin. I mean, Liverpool was the main port for England. It's where the American ships would come in. It was the nearest port to America,
right,
basically. And he was out in it every single day. And I swore there is no way that I wanted to be a docker. And when I was 11 years of age, I went up to him and said, "Dad, I want to learn how to tap dance."
Wow.
And he said, "I'm sorry."
Wow. The longshoreman's here in his
son. I could have failed right here, you know, at 11. But he said, "Okay, why?" And I told him that I'd seen a movie with Sammy Davis Jr. in, and he was tap dancing. It was Robin and the Seven Hoods, and he actually did a tap dance with a machine gun.
Wow.
And it was just exciting for a kid, I guess. And I thought, I'd like to do that. And it was either that or play the drums. And he thought, "Oh, that's good. you go tap dancing." And I went tap dancing, and I was pretty good at it. And we didn't have a lot of money, but the teacher said, "You should do other forms of dance because you're good and you don't have to pay for it. Just keep it to ourselves, but I'll teach you how to dance." And bless her little cotton socks, that's what she did. I became a dancer when I was 18. And took a job in a traveling show. It was a tour of an operetta called The Merry Widow. And I had pink tights on, pink ballet shoes. The tights went right up to my nipples. I had a little yellow bolero jacket with a red beret. And I looked like a dancing milkshake. And I swore, I am never going to do this again. I could not stand wearing tights. I mean, I just couldn't. It was uncomfortable. And thank goodness I got a television job in a group called The Young Generation. It was 15 boys, 15 girls. And it was the first time really that dancers got their names checked. Because before this, dancers were like traveling wallpaper behind a singer.
Sure.
You know, you're just jumping around behind the singer. But here we were given our own lines to say, songs to sing, and it was our own show, The Young Generation show. And it was tremendous. And I did that for 3 years.
Where was that? In London primarily?
In BBC Television.
Oh, BBC.
Yeah, and we had many shows. They sold a million, it was called, The Young Generation Show. We were also backup dancers for Cilla Black, Lulu, and all of the stars of the day. After 3 years, the choreographer left and went to ITV, and I was asked to take over the choreography. I was just one of those kids that, you know, I can do that, one of those, you know. And I suddenly realized that I really wasn't capable of doing this. We were doing 7 routines a week, and we were working something like 35 to 40 weeks a year, and it was really killing me. And that was leading up to, I guess, the stress of that, the stress of losing a girlfriend that I was madly in love with, was my first failure. And thank goodness I failed. I was 21 and I tried to commit suicide.
Oh.
And I failed trying to commit suicide, which I'm really grateful I failed for.
I'm happy you, know? You failed at that too.
At 21.
You just too much pressure?
It was just too much. But I got through it and got back on my feet, got my head right. And I was really successful as a choreographer, because it wasn't just about dance steps and dancing. I mean, I've worked with choreographers now that you put a piece of music on and they're sensational. They just move brilliantly. I wasn't that. I was more of a cerebral choreographer. I'd come up with ideas. So comedians wanted me to stage them and come up with ideas for comedians. So it took me on a totally different track, which took me into production, television production and direction. And moving along very rapidly to, I was 40. I was doing a lot of work in Europe. I was asked to go to East Berlin before the wall came down. So this was
70s?
Scary. This 60s? Was 75, 76.
Oh, yeah, you didn't go to East Berlin in 75 or 76. That well, was a scary place to go.
I had 90 dancers to choreograph in this theater that was just incredible. It was called the Friedrichstadtpalast. And it had this enormous stage, big revolving stage, which would drop down, move to the side. An ice rink would come out of the other side and come up with Katharina Witt, who was the world champion figure skater at the time.
Wow.
East German girl, gold medalist. That would drop down. And below that, a tank of water with a dolphin in it and a girl swimmer. And the act was the dolphin would take the girl's bra off. It would take 4 or 5 minutes to take this girl's bra off. And she'd swim around. And that was the act. It was an incredible experience because it was scary. I'd walk across Checkpoint Charlie just to go to West Berlin to eat food because I didn't really like the food in East Berlin. It was a very strange, dark place. And steal toilet rolls from out of the bathrooms in these restaurants. Because the paper, the toilet paper, was like emery paper. You know, it was a strange place. But you knew as you were walking from East Berlin to West Berlin that they actually had their gun sights on you. And as you walk into West Berlin, you can see the Americans with their binoculars. Who are you? Okay. So I do this every weekend, and I was there for 2 months. So they knew me. So it was okay.
What an incredible experience.
Another experience. And I looked on it. I wasn't allowed to take any money out of the country. So I had to take porcelain and a fur coat for my wife. The thing was with East Berlin is it gave me a lot of confidence because I didn't speak the language. They didn't speak English. And it gave me a lot of confidence to take on other work that I didn't know if I could do or not.
Can we go back? Because you were saying you skipped ahead and it's obviously a hard topic, but you tried to commit suicide, you said, when you were 21. And that was your first failure. And it sounds like, you know, you were in what a lot of 20-year-olds would say is success. Like, oh, I'm choreographing this show. It's, you know.
I never felt good enough.
So what was it?
I never felt good enough. It was, as I said earlier, it was 7 routines. So you would basically doing them overnight to walk in the next morning. And don't forget, before this, I was a dancer with the dancers and messed around just as much as the dancers. And now I'm the boss trying to stop them messing around while I'm thinking about what I'm going to do. So it was all uncomfortable. I'd lost friends.
Was it the pressure of work? Was it the pressure of life? Was it the feeling of like an imposter feeling, as they call it? Or what was the...
Well, it was also, I mean, I'd fallen in love with a lady and we split up. And I'd actually, we'd split up because I had this incredible show called 50 Years of Music that the BBC asked me to choreograph. And it was on this particular night on television. And we sat down to watch it together. And I was really proud that she was going to be seeing this. And the telephone rang and it was another guy. And she was on the telephone to this guy for the entire length of the show. And in those days, we didn't have video recordings.
Right. Right.
So she missed the show entirely, and it broke my heart. And she was leaving me for this other guy, and that broke my heart. So there was that mixed with the fact that I wasn't comfortable at work.
It's amazing, and I think, not to harp too much on it, but you know, when we look at where we are in life and what we perceive to be the deepest failures, that I mean, drove you, and you know, a lot of people get driven to extremes, like attempting to, you know, commit suicide. At that age, as to what was going through your head as failing?
I think mine was probably much more of emotional blackmail. It was taking a bottle of sleeping pills.
Yep.
You know, if you're going to actually commit suicide, jump off a building, they can't pump that out of you, you know? And when I woke up, my mother had come down from Liverpool and she was sat next to the bed as I came to. And this beautiful nurse was on the other side of the bed leaning over me. And I checked out her breasts. And I thought, why on earth did I even think of committing suicide?
There's the Nigel in it.
But it was like, it was, you know, my mum was in tears.
But it took that failure for you to pick your ass back up and say, what the hell am I doing? And let's get our shit in order, right?
Yeah.
You're in the hospital.
Yeah.
You're 21 years old. You got a ton of responsibility. This girl's kind of broken your heart. Your inner voice is like, what the fuck did I do? And now you come back with a vengeance, and you're in East Berlin of all places, in Soviet bloc era, choreographing a show with how many dancers?
And I was being followed from the hotel. The hotel was on the corner, and the theater was up the street, which I had to walk every day. And I was followed, I realized after the first week, by a little, it was called a Trabant, this little car that would follow me up. And when I came out of the theater, whatever time it came out, it would be there and follow me back to the hotel. And I found out later that it was the Stasi, the East German secret
police. To make
sure
you weren't like a spy.
But I wasn't going anywhere else, I guess.
Just because you could have been a spy for all they knew. Wow. So you're in this, like, I'll call it almost a hellhole, the way East Berlin has been described to me during Soviet bloc, where you've got limited resources. You said, you know, barely have toilet paper and food. And you're choreographing this show under the most extreme circumstances with, how many people? You said 80?
90. 70 girls, 20 boys.
Is that you were at that point, did you feel like you had succeeded, or were you kind of just like, where the hell am I? Or what'd you feel?
Fear. And that was the driver. And fear about communication as well.
Because a lot of people didn't speak English.
They were either Russian or East German or other Soviet bloc dancers.
So you were literally choreographing basically 100 people who didn't speak English.
Yeah, I know why you're a failure, because you keep getting all of your figures wrong. You've gone from 90 to 100.
Oh, it was 90. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, sorry. Math is not my strong suit. Math is my strong suit, shockingly.
It was tough. It was tough. Again, a challenge, and one that I wanted to do and one that I wanted to face.
So tell us what happened after that. So now you've come off this incredible challenge, probably feel like you can do anything. Yeah. And what's next?
I go and do, I move on into comedy and do television shows, producing and directing comedians. A really good impressionist called Bobby Davro, hugely successful show. And we are reenacting pop videos of the time. So we did the Queen video, David Bowie's Space Oddity. And it was great fun. Again, learning a great deal about camera tricks at that time. A thing called Color Separation Overlay came out, CSO, which we know as green screen basically now.
Yeah,
and so it was playing with that and having fun with that. To which then leads me to be asked to make an American show called American Gladiators in England. I'm also...
How old are you at this point now?
Oh, going into late 30s, okay. Early 40s.
You had a little success. You're building your career as a producer. You were already built your career as a choreographer. Now you're getting to be a respected producer, let's call it, in London.
Yep.
And you're taking an English show and making it into a British show, which must be feel pretty good because you've been asked to take a successful show. And
I'm asked to come over to Los Angeles to meet with Samuel Goldwyn Jr., who invites me to his home. And I'm really awkward to feed.
I've noticed.
No fish. I do like lamb, and they served lamb. But it must have just been shown the flame. Because it was all red raw. This is in his home, and I have to send it back 3 times to have it just...
In his house. So again, I just wanted people to get the context of this. There was really no studio at the time but MGM. I mean, you had Warner Brothers building and Paramount building. Paramount was on the brink of bankruptcy, and MGM was the studio. It basically controlled this industry. So you were working at MGM. The rest were kind of subpar.
So I'm embarrassed by the very fact I've got to do this. But what I said to him was, because I'd seen the American version here at Universal Studios, and what they did was they'd put up a piece of equipment and shoot 3 or 4 shows on that equipment. So different contestants came out. They had a walk-through audience. So the audience never got to see a show. They'd see maybe 4 games if they stayed there for 2 or 3 hours. With numerous contestants, but didn't know who won, who didn't win, who got knocked out. So it felt really uncomfortable. I said, I want to do it as a complete show. And he said, well, the equipment was huge. It was hang tough with rings and the eliminator course. He said, you're going to need a really big place to lay out the equipment. So I took over in England the National Indoor Arena, which was the Olympic Arena in Birmingham. And we laid out all of the equipment. And what we couldn't lay out, it was only a question of wheeling something else out. I used all of the Americana with it from your football games so that there was music blaring out as different gladiators came on. The Boys Are Back in Town was the, you know, wild thing and great music. And big foam hands, which we'd never seen in England. So we choreographed the audience. And on the first show, I remember it was a bit like Moses and the Red Sea, because only about 300 people turned up in the 7,000-seat arena. And we would look at the camera shot and this way, and the whole audience would run around and sit behind that camera shot. This way, and then all run round to the other side. And we had to literally choreograph the audience. After that first season, it became enormous.
Really?
And we were doing 2 shows a day, 7,000 people in each show.
That's a big
It was enormous. Show. And it was so big that we got the very first sponsorship for a television program from Kellogg's Corn Flakes.
And at the time, Kellogg's was like one of the biggest brands
so
in the world.
So this was just...
That's like you've made it now. If Kellogg's is sponsoring you, you've made it.
Made it.
My life, I'm now in the big leagues.
Now, even better, they now ask me to become the boss. They ask me to become the controller of entertainment and comedy at London Weekend Television. This is...
It's like the job.
The job.
So you got Goldwyn, you've got MGM having you in his house, you've got...
We're asked to make the show for America.
You're taking the show to America.
We're now making the American show in England.
Amazing. You've changed the way audiences view you. You're filling up 7,000 seats, unheard of. You get the
greatest thing. I'm there.
This first is sponsorship. It. Kellogg's in.
This is it.
You've arrived.
Yeah.
And what happens?
Now I'm doing my first show as the boss. It was the biggest failure that I've ever had in my career. It was another version of Gladiators on ice. And it was called Ice Warriors. And we came up with crazy games of jousting, joust poles, just like, you know, knights of the round table, different ends of the ice rink and charge towards each other with these jousting poles. We had this big sort of clock face with different arms coming off it that you had to jump over or go underneath, that was being spun by these ice warriors, and the contestants had to either jump over them or duck under them or be chopped in half. I mean, it was incredible on paper.
Back in East Berlin.
We did the mythology of it, and we spent so much time with the mythology of it that we didn't really care about the people.
Mm.
And we had the ice master, who was 6'7", who couldn't even stand up on the ice. So we kept him off the ice. My presenter was a lady called Danny Bear, beautiful woman. She's now a realtor in Beverly Hills and being very successful. But at that point, she looked gorgeous. She lied to me and said, oh, yes, I'm a great ice skater. And I didn't audition her. She couldn't stand up on the ice.
Oh, no.
So we would sort of, she'd give her a little push and she'd sort of come out, and now from the ice city of Birmingham. And she was so stiff because she was worried about falling over. That didn't work. The games got taken off us by safety 3 days before we do the shoot. You can't do that jousting. That's too dangerous. No. The jousting, they chopped off the, we lost 3 other games. We had one with a sort of very thick elastic band where you ran away from each other. And whichever one gave up first time, they'd be pulled back and yanked back. And can't do that. It's too dangerous. So we were really short of games. It was just a nightmare to shoot. And the first show went out and got the worst critics ever. And I had to watch as 9 other shows went out every week. And don't forget, I've produced it. I've directed it. I'm the boss.
This is your baby.
It is disaster. And what I learned from it, which was really important that I've applied ever since, is it's not about the games. It's not about anything other than the people. And if you don't know the people, if you don't care for the people, it's like watching a boxing match where you don't really give a shit about who's who.
Right.
It doesn't mean anything. Or a team that, you know, a football team for me, where you don't really know who they are. If you don't care about the team,
yep,
you don't care about the game.
That's true.
And if you didn't care about the contestants or what were the ice warriors or the gladiators, really, it didn't mean anything. So the show just disappeared